This is Bob Gilgore. I'm interviewing Ed Caldwell at 107 Caldwell Street on May 29th in the year 2000. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Bob.
I'd like to start with a little different topic this morning than what we did yesterday. Can you tell me what changes saw in society in Orange County and Chapel Hill during your high school days and your college days? I assume that's when the civil rights movement really got off the ground. Maybe it was a little later, correct me.
It was a little later. I finished high school in 1952. Civil rights movement really got started in 1954 after Brown versus Plessy. That's when the Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal was unconstitutional. It also started when King had the bus boycott. 1954, I was in Hampton. Two important things happened. One, King came to Hampton to address our assembly to talk about the bus boycott. And it was just the best speech I've ever heard. Just very moving, very dynamic man. Generally, I used to go to the assemblies and go to sleep. I carried me a pillow with me because it was mandatory that we go, and that was my way to rebel against having to go to the assembly. It was just magnetic, you know, just being there with King. Have them talk about that. Soon after that, in May, the Supreme Court ruled, and I remember sitting in my dorm room when they said that schools segregation was unconstitutional and that they should dismantle segregation with all deliberate speed. I took that to mean immediately. I really believed in the Supreme Court as being fair, just, and I always looked at that statute with the balance, with the blindfold on, and I really believed that. In my dorm room that day, we were just talking as to what that meant. And I said to my colleagues that I didn't think I was coming back to Hampton, that I was going to University of North Carolina. I always thought that I should go to University of North Carolina, just family being associated with the university. But I always just thought I would be going to the University of North Carolina. I'll go into more about that in detail as to why. But I said to my colleagues that I really would miss Hampton. And I had mixed emotions about not coming back. But I thought I owed it to my parents to go to school in Chapel Hill and therefore save money. I was very naive, you know, to believe that they would open up the university. But those were the two times that I remember sort of being a changed person. One of the things about Hampton, Hampton trained all its graduates with two goals, objectives in mind. Number one, to give back to that university, so therefore it could continue. It was a private school, so alumni always gave money back to the school. Second thing was that anybody that graduated from Hampton should be a leader, should go back into their communities and be a leader. So that was, those two things were instilled in me, and so therefore I sort of felt. I returned home after graduation, applied for a job in my field, which was chemistry, knowing full well that I would not be hired. After a certain period of time, I left home because I refused, with all that education and all the money that my parents had spent, take a job at the Carolina Inn, you know, waiting table, whatever. Just were no jobs for blacks and during that time. So I left, going north, stayed for a period of time with my aunt in Washington, tried to get a job with the government. I did not have sufficient hours. The government said you had to have 30 hours in your field. I had 28. That was because Hampton made sure all his graduates had educational courses so that you could teach if you couldn't get a job doing anything else. So I was short 2 hours. And so I went on to New York and to get a job. Rude awakening. Jobs were very difficult to get. I had an inflated idea as to how hard I had to work in chemistry and what ought to be paid. When my money started to run out, I accepted a job much less than what I thought I should be paid. I went to work for Columbia University in a biochemical lab. Learned a lot there. One of the things that I learned was, even though I was in the North, it was very little difference between the North and the South, except that in the North, they disguised discrimination a little bit better than they did in the South. The South, they were blatant about it. In the North, they played games with it. And I found out that even though I had a college degree, there were persons of the other persuasion being able to get jobs from Hammond High School education and just sort of bypassing me, you know, even though I had a college degree. I got smart and I began to learn everything that I could about chemistry and how to save the hospital money. And so where they used to call in service people to repair things, I began to repair. I used to watch the service people and see what they were doing, and therefore I learned that I was able to do whatever. And so they didn't really have to call them in because I could do everything that they were doing. There was a man named Dr. Samuel Graff who was over the biochemistry department. He was conducting research on cancer, and under him was the biochemical lab. Dr. Graff was preparing some of the more technical electronic equipment. All he couldn't fix, he'd call a man, service people in, and I'd watch the service people, and I got to the point, man, that I was just as good as the service people in fixing a plane photographer piece of equipment. And so I remember Dr. Graff coming down one time trying to fix the equipment, and I was telling him he was doing it all wrong, and he threw the wrench down and cursed and said, "Damn it, you do it." And I did it. And from then on, they didn't call the man in. I did it. And I started to move very rapidly because I had a special knowledge that nobody else had. And I told Dr. Graff I was leaving. And because I was valuable, you know, the raises began to come. Soon after that, I think I was married. and I needed more money, you know, to raise a family. And so they gave me about as many raises as they could humanly possibly give. And people at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center were beginning to question, why was this one person getting all these raises? You know. But I became very valuable to them. And one of the things I started to, they gave me a job that was dedicated to medical students so that they could make money while they were in school. And one of those jobs, you know, was given to me. So therefore I was on call for all emergencies. And so therefore I got paid more. So I was able to supplement my income enough to raise a family. And I became very valuable to that chemistry lab. Dr. Graf went to Russia on sabbatical, and he put me in charge of not only that lab, but the whole biochemical department. And so therefore, persons who had PhDs and so forth, they had to come to me. I made all decisions. I ordered all supplies, you know, and I just did the whole thing. People were pretty nice about the fact that I was in charge, you know. When Dr. Graf came back, he looked at the books and so forth and said, you've done such a good job, why don't you just continue to do this? So that's what I did. So I became supervisor of the lab and whatever. I was still ordering supplies and wherever. So therefore they could give me increase in salaries and so forth because of my responsibilities. I began to do research on procedures and so forth that we use, you know, to test to see whether or not we could use those procedures, if they were accurate enough and that sort of thing. I remember where I ran into some problems with the people in the lab was when they were going to have the march in Washington. And I said that I was going to the march in Washington, and people in the lab said I didn't think I ought to go. Okay. At that point, I said, hey, I'm not going to let nobody tell me what to do and what I should not do. I got time, you know, these people have gotten too much into my private life to tell me that I shouldn't go to that march. And they sort of held that on my head, if I go, there were going to be repercussions and so forth. And so I said to myself I was going anyway.
What year was that?
That had to be in the year of 63, that summer of 63. I kind of fell out with the people that I was working with. You know, we just didn't see eye to eye. During that summer, after the March on Washington, I came home for vacation. You know, and my father, I had two children at the time, and he tried to get me to come home so I guess he could be near the grandchildren. So I applied for a job here at the University of North Carolina's hospital biochemical lab. The hospital was having all kinds of problems with accuracy and so forth with their procedures. And I interviewed for the job, and with my background and so forth, the fellow hired me. During that time, I also interviewed with Research Triangle Park. They were also interested in me coming to work for them. So I went back and I gave them notice. I gave them a month's notice so that they train somebody, whatever. I knew that I didn't have to give him for 2 weeks, but I gave him a month. They said to me that they were willing to pay to have my parents come live in New York. And I said to them, you don't know anything at all about my parents or whatever. My parents been in Chapel Hill for many generations, and I don't think they'd want to come to New York to live. Okay. Just no concept of who my parents were or what. And at that point, I just said, well, you know, I'm resigning. They did everything they could to try to talk me out of coming back home, but my mind was made up. The reason I knew it was 1963, November, around Thanksgiving time, and it was when I prepared to move, was that was when Kennedy was assassinated. So I remember going around doing all the whatever you need to do to terminate the job and so forth when I heard that he had been assassinated. I was supposed to report to work in Chapel Hill, so I was here. I went back down to the university, and the doctor had said he really apologized, but my application had been held up. No way that he could get it released. They found out that I was black, and so therefore they were not going to give me that position. So I said, fine. So I went to work with the Research Triangle Park. I always resented the fact, you know, that I did not go to work for the hospital. Going back, not only did I think that I ought to go to school at the University of North Carolina, I also thought that I ought to work for the University of North Carolina. And the fact that they turned me down, you know, always, that was a resentment. And I tried for several positions with university, which they were all turned down for one reason or another. So that's how I went to work in the Research Triangle Park. Gotten off of what I was supposed to be talking about.
All interesting. The changes that you saw in society.
One of the things in coming back, civil rights movement was in full bloom. It was very difficult, even though I had grown up in Chapel Hill, to get involved to the extent, because they had a lot of outside persons leading the civil rights movement. One was Howard Fuller from Durham, and some others. So I tried to get involved, but there were a lot of things I disagreed with. One of the things I disagreed with was they had planned a march, and they were going to put the old folks out front. And that was right after it was reported that there were people that had come into town to stop that march. That was when Lester Maddox in Georgia had the axe hounds and so forth. And we had reliable information that some of the people had come up from Georgia, man, with their picking, the hounds, whatever. And they were going to stop that march. And some of the black leaders said, well, we'll put the old folks out and the children. And I said, hey, I disagree with this. I mean, I respect these people. I grew up with these older persons. These are the parents of my schoolmates and so forth. And I just said, I disagree with that. I will not be a part of anything that you that you endanger the lives of older citizens and children. So I didn't participate anymore. So I started to work in voter registration. Okay. My feeling at the time was I thought the civil rights movement was going along very well. They didn't need me. And I needed to. If we were going to ever gain any power, it should be political power. And so at that time, Rebecca Clark introduced me to some persons that were starting a project on voter registration. And I worked with a young man named Tony Mason. He was white. He also wanted to work in the civil rights movement, but his parents were professors and they were afraid that he may get hurt. So they said he could work in voter registration. So we worked together. Okay. We registered a lot of people. Okay. We registered a lot of people. Not only in Chapel Hill, but the county. I mean, Tony went into places, man, that I was afraid to go into. I mean, they were known to be Klan havens, man, and I just didn't have the nerve that he had. But after we registered persons, you know, I felt that it's no use registering if we don't get them out to vote. So I started working and turning out the vote. My father at that time was involved in the Democratic Party and working with Martha McKay and Virginia Nichols. They were the shakers and movers, man, in the Democratic Party. I mean, they knew how to do it. So I started working with them. I learned everything I could from them. Okay. And so therefore, I started to turn out vote in the black community. We had that thing down to a science. And even though we were in the minority, we could turn the vote out, we could change elections and so forth. I organized all the precincts, I organized everything. We went to the colleges, man, and got students from Bennett, which was a sociology class, and we talked to the professor and giving them credit if they worked in the campaign. But it was highly organized. Business with Sandy McClamrock and others, man, controlled Chapel Hill. They controlled all elections. It was about 100 business people, man, that you know, they were in power. We soon changed that. They had plenty of money. And they started to try to buy elections by getting blacks to stand at the polls and confuse people. And we raised money, and you know, Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts gave us money, man, and we bought the blacks off, man, and that sort of thing. We told them to take the people's money, but here's what you do. And so we started to elect a few people. We elected Howard Lee, you know, mainly because I didn't know Howard at the time. And, we put together a political organization called PROD. PROD was an integrated political organization. It was not just black, we had everybody. We needed people, professors and so forth, man, because they brought a lot to the organization. They could solicit and get money. We had people working with the YMCA that could get in meetings and find out what they were plotting and planning and so forth. I was head of PROD, and I convinced, you know, the white counterparts that we needed to have a black in the forefront. Blacks would not take direction from somebody other than somebody that looked like them. So they were willing to do that. Pride came apart when I was appointed to the Chapel Hill Carver School Board. Now, I ran for several positions, you know, and did not win. I ran for school board when I first came back home. It was really too early to run, so I really didn't know everything you need to know about running a campaign. I ran for the county, ran for county commissioner. There was 10 people in the race. And by that time, I was very astute as to how I run a campaign. Out of those 10, let me back up and say, family connections and knowing everybody, I was able to do very well, not only in Chapel Hill, but the county. My mother taught school in Cedar Grove in Orange County, so a lot of people knew her. A lot of people knew my father, man, from Hunt. But one thing that helped me most was my uncle was principal of the school in Hillsborough. His name A.L. Standback. Well, they got a middle school named after A.L. Standback. But everybody knew A.L. Standback. Everybody knew my aunt. Okay. I had a lot of family that lived in Northern Orange, the Whittets. So I took that very seriously. I was running with Jimmy Wallace and George. I can't remember the name. He's a pharmacist now with Kroger's. But they were also running, and I told them I was running independent. They wanted to put me in with George and Jimmy Wallace, and I said, no, I'm running independent campaign. I won't be in with no coalition. Because I felt, man, I had more going. Okay. After that first election, I led ticket. Okay. I missed out by 20 votes of having a majority, so I didn't have to go into a runoff. Okay. And when I went into a runoff, I knew that I could win. Okay. One reason that the university closed down during that time and all my people that I counted on to vote was going away on vacation. The other thing was that the county pooled together to make sure I didn't win. Okay. So I got about the same amount of votes, but all the votes that went to the other candidates went to the white candidates, and they just killed me. The other thing that happened, Bob, was people that had supported me said it wouldn't support me anymore because they thought that I had called for what they call a bullet vote, single shot. They just couldn't see how I could do that well in an election, so they wouldn't support me. That hurt. I had letters and so forth. People that I thought that considered friends, you know, they just told me that to my face, you know. So it killed me. I didn't do very well at all, you know. So I didn't win. And then there was a resignation on the school board, and Norma Wellerly and some others approached me and said that they'd like to support me, would I be willing to serve on the school board. And I told them, yeah, I would serve. And that's how I got on the school board. I don't know if I could ever ran an election and won to get on there, but once I was on there, I guess that I became effective as a school board member, and so I really had no problem running again and winning. So, things still were very slow to open up. And it was,
things were slow to open up?
Yeah. Chapel Hill was considered to be a very liberal place, with university and the professors and so forth. And, one of the big things was public accommodations. Was my day, the restaurants were going to open its doors to serving blacks, and, you know, therefore you could go in and sit down and that sort of thing. And all that revolved around the Greensboro sit-ins and so forth. So it started to spread all over North Carolina. The town was very divided as to whether they would serve blacks. So Chapel Hill is not as liberal as everybody said it was. There were some very good liberal people. The town still was kind of conservative. Having served on school board, more and more, I guess that's where people start to respect me as a person, and I guess what I stood for. I'd have to say just serving on school board.
But what did you stand for?
I was for all kids, not just black kids. My philosophy was, if it's good enough for white kids, it ought to be good enough for black kids. And I was not going to push, you know, that black kids have any special whatever. That they need to get in and get a good education. Okay. They played balls and so forth and didn't hit the books, then they couldn't play. You know, and they came to me, and I just said no. Parents and so forth, they didn't get the books, man, they didn't play. Started working with teachers and so forth, trying to break down stereotypes and so forth, you know, that some teachers had against black kids. Black kids started to disrupt, you know, the schools and close down, and they had a sense of power. You know, first time, you know, they felt that they were powerful and therefore they could call shots. They were in control. You know, they had meetings and so forth, and mass meetings and so forth, and I just stood up and said, hey, be part of this. Parents, you need to take the leadership and responsibility back. Kids were talking about closing school and running their own schools. That's it. We ain't got enough money, okay? What makes you think that we can run some schools? You know, even if the church let us have the building, we don't have the money, the supplies, or whatever, okay? We're going to make the schools work for our children, not separate, okay?
Why did they want to run their own schools?
Just power, okay? These kids were very powerful.
Did they disagree with integration?
Well, at the time, integration did not, okay. They felt that they lost many things that they had in the black schools, which we did.
What kind of things did you lose?
Of came, we lost our teachers, you know. Our teachers really inspired, even though we didn't have the materials and whatever, they took a special interest in our kids, man, and pushed down wherever kid had potential, you know, they pushed that kid in there and got the resources and so forth, and inspired and motivated the kids to do well. When they integrated, they really got rid of the black teachers. Based on the fact that it attends some of the universities and so forth that some of the whites did. Just a difference in philosophy. We had one of the best bands, we had one of the best football teams. Our kids were excelling. And when they went into the integrated thing, they didn't excel. They got pushed to the side. So, you know, they just said, we don't want to be a part of this. We don't want to be a part of integration. We want to run our own separate school. Logistically, we couldn't pull that off. Okay. I had no money to pay no teachers. You know, I mean, just, it was a nightmare. And then, ideally, it sounded good, but when you get right down to it and looked at it, it was unrealistic. And I was one of the first to say, we dropped the ball. We worked very hard to integrate the schools, but then once they were integrated, we went to sleep. We just thought everything would be taken care of, where we should have continued to negotiate and whatever, just to make sure that those schools were serving our kids. And they weren't. So therefore we had a lot of things to go back and try to correct.
And how are they not serving?
That was supposed to be a consolidated school. Okay. What they did was just bring the black kids into the school. Okay. It had the name. Chapel Hill High School, was no discussion at all about those things that were very dear and precious to us that came from Lincoln. Okay. School colors, school mascot, they left the trophies. We had won several state championships and left all those trophies down in Lincoln. Did not bring them to the high school. Department heads were all white, and blacks were never considered. Mr. C.A. McDougall, who was a very strong administrator and had a lot of graduate courses at Columbia University in education, he became the assistant principal. And when you look at his credentials, he was much stronger. With graduate credentials, and Ms. Marshbank, who became principal, only had a college degree. Okay? You know, so as you went right down the line, no blacks, administrators, teachers, or whatever, carried the same kind of power, status, decision making. You know, at the new school. The kids got pushed aside. Okay. They were put in courses and so forth that said that they were, all the positions in the student body, like president, whatever, you know, you just didn't get elected or whatever. And coaches were white and everything was white. What they did was bring black kids into that school and just sort of push them aside. And kids were telling us, but we didn't listen to them. Until one day they disrupted. Okay. They disrupted over something that happened at graduation. where they had marshals to walk in with the graduating class, and no black, even though they put their names up, were ever elected. So the kids just routed to a school. They got their attention. So therefore, after that, you know, they had these groups gathered to work on the solving some of the problems. So it's hard to change behavior, you know, and part of what I was doing was trying to get the school board to run in service education on diversity and things like that. The people that really need to be there didn't come. It was, I mean, they could come if they wanted to, freedom of choice and whatever. And so, you know, I worked for the whole time I was on the hearing, on the school board, and we passed policies and so forth, but it didn't really get implemented down into the schools the way it should have been. Okay. All that depended on whoever was principal of the school. Some tried, some didn't. Some just didn't listen to the superintendent. Okay. And if things going to get implemented, it's got to be from the principals. Principals felt caught getting school board and the superintendent's direction, and having very strong teachers and so forth said, we're not going to do that. So, you know, you got very strong teachers that have been there for 30 years and got the parents backing, you know, they did it just like they wanted to. So I guess when I left the school board, if I look back, there were a lot of things that had been accomplished. There were a lot of things that still need to be accomplished.
How long were you on the school board?
About 13 years or more.
And what do you feel that your accomplishments were, and what would you have liked to, if it wasn't there?
One thing is we integrated all the schools. I say integrated, I meant that we had a racial balance policy that schools had to reflect the racial balance of the community. If any schools fell below that, then we'd have a redistricting. Okay. We had built into that bus routes and so forth, where we really tried not to destroy communities and that sort of thing. So if kids played together in a community, you know, we tried to move all kids together into a particular school. That was very effective because that was the only way that they could begin to break down some of the feelings about certain schools. For an example, Carver was always considered a mill town. They considered Carver a redneck. And there were people from Estes Hill that had said, we're not sending our kids down to that redneck school. But Bob, when you get right down to it, Carver is one of our best schools, man. Okay? I mean, when you look at the teachers that we put in there and the facility and whatever, but these were perceptions in people's mind, okay? They elected me. I was chairman of the redistricting committee, okay? And one of the things that I was able to do, not that I thought about it or planned it, it's just by instinct. I knew it was a very explosive issue when you talk about racial balance and moving people's kids and whatever. And I had these meetings all over town. And I let people come, man, and just vent. You know, I let them have their input. Parents participated in the redistricting committee meetings and so forth. By the time we got ready to submit the plan to the school board, those parents felt that they had input and therefore they had some ownership. Okay? I had no problems, man. You know? And if you say, did I plan to do that? No, it was just sort of by instinct. Okay? And people were, I mean, they were, it was their plan, and they supported it. So therefore, they thought it was going to be a lot more explosive and that sort of thing, and it just sort of went through with a whimper. There were some things, man, that were compromised with the first redistricting plan, you know, that I had wanted to get through that didn't get through. So next time we worked on a little bit more until the redistricting plan that I supported got put in place. These things just sort of came in instinct. Okay, one of the things also happened was that we had blacks and so forth on this redistricting committee that worked for some of the white parents. Okay. They were afraid to speak up. Parents put pressure on them. I know one young lady lost her job because she didn't support what her boss wanted her to support. That kind of pressure. So when I began to count votes, I'm looking at these blacks